This speech is about the free software movement and the GNU project, which are very closely connected. What is free software? Free software means software that respects the user's freedom. Free software is the exception, and was even more the exception 20 years ago. Most software is proprietary software. That is, most software available for you to get a copy of is proprietary software. Proprietary software keeps the users divided and helpless. They're divided because each user is forbidden to share with anybody else. And they're helpless because none of the users have the source code, so they can't change anything. They can't even verify what it's really doing. So proprietary software is just trust me software. But free software respects the user's freedom. What does that mean? That's a very general statement. Let me make it more specific. Free software means that users have four essential freedoms. That's the definition of free software. And these freedoms are freedom zero, the freedom to run the program as you wish for whatever purpose. Freedom one is the freedom to help yourself. That's the freedom to study the source code of the program and then change it to do what you wish. Freedom two is the freedom to help your neighbor. That's the freedom to make copies and distribute them to others when you wish. And freedom three is the freedom to help build your community. That's the freedom to distribute or publish modified versions when you wish. With all four of these freedoms, the program is free software. If one of these freedoms is missing, substantially missing, then it is proprietary software. Its development is unethical, and you shouldn't use it. If you want to keep your freedom, you mustn't use it. But why are these four freedoms essential? What makes these four the essential freedoms? Why should we define free software this way? Freedom two is necessary on basic ethical grounds so that you can live an upright life as a good member of your community. If you use a program that does not give you freedom number two, then you are in danger of finding yourself at any moment in a moral dilemma. Whenever your friend says, "That's a nice program, could I have a copy?" At that moment, you will be compelled to choose between two evils. One evil is to give your friend a copy and violate the license of the program. The other evil is to deny your friend a copy and comply with the license of the program. Now, once you're in this situation, you ought to choose the lesser of the two evils. The lesser evil is to give your friend a copy and violate the license of the program. Now, what makes this evil lesser? The reason is that we can presume your friend has treated you well and deserves your cooperation. If he hasn't, of course, you can tell him, "I don't want to help you. Start acting like a nice guy. Then I'll help you." So the case that's interesting is the case where this person has cooperated, is a good person, and deserves, in general, your cooperation. Whereas the developer of the program has deliberately tried to divide you from your friends, which is extremely evil. So if you can't help doing something wrong, better you should pick the wrong that's directed at him rather than the wrong that's directed at your friends and your community. However, to be the lesser evil does not mean it is good. It's never entirely a good thing to break any agreement, even though some agreements are better broken than kept. And if you do give your friend a copy, it will still be a non-free proprietary program. The only thing in the field of computing that's worse than an unauthorized copy of a non-free program is an authorized copy of a non-free program, which has the same restrictions, the same injustice to the users, and in addition, typically rewards the perpetrator of the scheme as well. So once you have understood this moral dilemma, once you know that it's waiting at the end of the path, what you should really do is don't go down that path. Don't take the action that will lead you to a moral dilemma. There are two ways to avoid that this particular moral dilemma. One of them is don't have any friends. And that's apparently what the developers of proprietary software would like you to do. And the other is don't use proprietary software. If you don't use software that denies you freedom number two, then you'll never be in this dilemma. Once I was in the audience when John Perry Barlow gave a speech, and he asked people, raise your hand if you have no unauthorized copies of software. And he was surprised to see a hand go up. And then he saw it was me, and he said, oh, of course, you, Stallman, because he understood why I have no unauthorized copies of software, because all my copies of software are free software, and everyone can make authorized copies, including me, including you. The most essential resource of any society is not a physical resource. It's a psychosocial resource. It's the spirit of helping your neighbor, the spirit of goodwill. This spirit makes the difference between a livable society and a dog-eat-dog jungle. So it's no accident that the world's major religions for thousands of years have explicitly promoted this spirit of goodwill. So what does it mean when powerful social institutions start saying that it's wrong to share? What are they doing? They are poisoning this spirit of goodwill. Something that no society can afford. No society has too much spirit of goodwill. And what does it mean when they say that if you share with your neighbor, then you're a pirate? What are they doing? They are trying to equate helping your neighbor with attacking ships. And nothing could be more wrong than that, because attacking ships is very, very bad. But helping your neighbor is admirable. And what does it mean when they impose harsh punishments on people who share, such as when they sue those people for more money than they're ever likely to see in their lives? What does it mean? And there are proposals for it to put these people in prison for years. How much fear is it going to take before your neighbors are too scared to share with you? How much fear is it going to take before you're too scared to share with them? I don't think you want to live in a society permeated by this level of fear. So I think we should bring the terror campaign of the proprietary software developers to an end. And I use that term terror campaign with due thought. In two different countries, they have threatened the public with being raped for having unauthorized copies of proprietary software. And I think that when they threaten people with rape, the term terror campaign is justified. That's the reason for freedom number two, the freedom to help your neighbor, the freedom to make copies and distribute them to others. Freedom zero is necessary for different reasons, totally different reasons. So you can have control of your computer. Shocking as it may seem, there are proprietary programs that actually restrict how the user is allowed to run them. They may restrict what you can do with them, what you can use them for, how much you can run them, how long you can run them, who can run them on your machine. And this is obviously not having control of your computer. So Freedom Zero is essential, but it's not enough. Because Freedom Zero just means you're free to do whatever the developer set the program up to do. So you still don't have control over it. You have as much control as the developer chose to let you have. For real control over your computer, you need freedom number one as well. That's the freedom to study the source code and change it to do what you want. So that with freedom number one, you make the decisions about what the program will do instead of having the developer make those decisions and impose them on you. If you don't have freedom number one, you can't even tell what the program is really doing. And lots of non-free programs have malicious features. Features that were designed not to serve the user, but rather to spy on the user, annoy the user, restrict the user, or attack the user. For instance, many non-free programs are spyware. One non-free program that you may have heard of that spies on the user is called Windows XP. When the user of Windows XP searches her own files for a word, Windows sends a message to Microsoft saying what the word was. I don't know why, but I've seen proof that it's doing so. That's one spy feature, but it's not the only one. When Windows XP asks for an upgrade, it reports the complete list of software installed on the machine. Another spy feature. Now, these spy features were not trivial to discover. The list of software installed is sent encrypted, so people couldn't tell from watching network traffic that that's what was being sent. It took some clever investigation to determine that that information was present in the message. Microsoft would rather people not know that it's spying on them. It never told people it was spying on them in this way. But please don't think that Windows is a special case. Windows Media Player also spies on the user. And it spies completely. It reports everything that the user looks at, or so I'm told. But it's not that Microsoft is specially evil, because RealPlayer spies on the user the same way, and the TiVo spies on the user the same way. The TiVo is a particularly interesting case, because when the TiVo came out, lots of people in the free software community applauded. The TiVo contains a lot of free software. And the people in our community who thought that the goal was for our software's popularity, they were delighted. They thought, oh look, this important product is using our software. Isn't that great for us? But the TiVo also contains non-free software, and it spies on the user. And this shows us that it's not enough for a product to, quote, use free software, unquote. The goal is that the product not use any non-free software. That's what it takes to fully respect your freedom. Don't bring in any non-free software. Nasty features don't stop with spying, however. Some of them are designed to annoy the user. For instance, they display ads on the screen frequently. Now, initially, these developers just assumed that the users wouldn't know how to cancel this out. And then some users started figuring it out and telling other users how to turn it off. So they put it in their licenses. You're not allowed to run this program and do anything to turn off the ads. And this way, they can threaten to sue anybody who tells other people how to turn off the ads. And then there's the functionality of refusing to function, where the program says, I don't want to show you this file. I don't want to let you copy a few lines from this file. I don't want to print this file for you, because I don't like you. This is also known as digital restrictions management, or DRM, the functionality of refusing to function for you, because you're not good enough. And then there are back doors. Now it looks like this room has a back door, but maybe that's not very dangerous. I'm talking about back doors in software. I'm told there was a popular non-free program which then failed as a business and was liberated. And when the users could see the source code, they saw it had had a back door all along. So they took it out. When it's free software, A, you can see it, and B, you can take it out. But while it was non-free, they couldn't do either one. Unfortunately, I don't remember the name of that program, but one non-free program that has a back door that you might have heard of is called Windows XP. You see, when Windows XP asks for an upgrade, Microsoft knows the user's identity. So Microsoft can provide that user with an upgrade designed specifically for him, which is to say Microsoft has total control and can substitute anything, can break anything, install any nasty feature it might want, make the machine stop running entirely, and there's nothing the user can do about it. Microsoft could install a version that will let Microsoft read all the user's files, whatever it wants. It's been established that one piece of Microsoft software had a backdoor installed for the sake of the NSA, which, as we know, is totally unscrupulous and believes it's entitled to spy on anyone and anything, and that laws mean nothing for it. That's who you are trusting, if you trust a non-free software developer. You never know which of these companies might have claimed that being a good citizen meant letting a fascist regime spy on everyone. And that's the backdoor that we know, the backdoors we know about. In India, I was told that they had arrested some programmers working on development of Windows XP and accused them of working simultaneously for Al-Qaeda, installing a backdoor that Microsoft wasn't supposed to know about. That attempt apparently failed. Was there another attempt that succeeded? It would be hard for us to tell, since we can't even try to study the source code. I won't claim that all developers of non-free software put in malicious features. Some do and some don't. But they're all human, so they all make mistakes. For instance, they all introduce bugs into their code. It's impossible to avoid this. They all design features that people don't like. No one is perfect. And the users are just as helpless against these unintended mistakes as they are against deliberate malice. If you use a non-free program, you're a prisoner of your software. We, the developers of free software, are also human. We also make mistakes. Our programs also have bugs, because every non-trivial program has bugs. We also design features that everyone or some people don't like. No one is perfect. The difference is that we don't keep you a prisoner of these bugs and misfeatures. You're free to change them. You're free to make the software run any way you like it. because we respected your freedom. That's the crucial difference. We think it matters that we're not perfect. The developers of non-free software, I'm sure they know they're not perfect. They just don't care. Because fundamentally, your rights don't matter to them. But freedom number one is not enough to give users control of their own computers. Because, first of all, there are millions of computer users that don't know how to program and are not personally capable of exercising freedom number one. This is the freedom to personally study and change the code. Those who don't know how to program can't directly do this. But even for us programmers, freedom number one is not enough because there's too much software. In fact, right now, there's too much free software. There's so much free software that nobody can study it all and personally master it and personally make all the changes she might envision making in this code. So the only way we can fully take control, fully effectively, is to do it working together. And for that, we need freedom number three, the freedom to help build your community, the freedom to distribute or publish modified versions when you wish. This enables us to work together to make the changes that we jointly want. Any group of people can work together. So if there's a free program and most people want it to develop in this direction, various people will make and release changes so it will develop in this direction. If there are few people who want it to develop in this direction, then they will make slower progress in this direction, probably slower. Of course, it depends how enthusiastic they are to do the work. And if nobody wants it to change in this direction, it won't. Only people who know how to program can directly participate in making the changes, but all the users get to participate in deciding which ones are popular, deciding which versions, which changes to adopt. So if there are a million people who use a free program and they who want a certain change, by chance, a few thousand of them will know how to program. And sooner or later, a few of them will make that change and publish their modified version. And then all those million users can switch to that modified version. They'll all get the change they wanted. Only a few of them had to do the work. The rest just had to decide to adopt it. And thus, everyone gets the benefit of freedom, of all these freedoms, even though only people who know how to program can directly exercise freedoms 1 and 3. Of course, all users can exercise freedom 0 and 2, the freedom to run the program and the freedom to distribute copies. You don't have to know how to program to make copies of a program and share it with other people. What if there are just 1,000 people who are using a certain program and want a certain change? They can still, and suppose none of them knows how to program, they can still take advantage of these freedoms to get what they want. One of them can publish an announcement to get in touch with the others. And once they're in touch, they can start an organization. And the idea is that they all join the organization, and to do so, they have to pay dues. Suppose each member has to pay $100. Then the organization will have $100,000 with which it could pay a couple of programmers for a year. So it could make a big change for that much money. If they wanted a small change, maybe they just have to charge $10. To do this, of course, the organization has to hire people. So they'll talk to some programmers and say, show us please what the work you've done before, your portfolio, and when do you think you could do this and how much will you charge? And if they're not entirely happy with the answer, they can ask a different group of programmers, what have you done? What would you charge? When could you do this work? And then they can choose, which shows that free software implies a free market for all sorts of support and service. By contrast, proprietary software means a monopoly for support, because it typically means a monopoly because only the developer has the source code, so only the developer can make any change. The users who want to change have to beg that developer, please pay attention to me, please make the change I want, please. And sometimes the developer says, pay us and we'll listen to your trouble report. And if the user pays, the developer says, thank you, in 6 months there will be an upgrade. Buy the upgrade and you'll see if we fixed your problem, and you'll see what new problems we have in store for you. But with free software, anyone who has a copy can study the source code, master it, and begin offering support. Thus we have a free market. And therefore, for those users that really value good support, they can in general expect to get better support for free software through the free market. But this shows us something paradoxical. You see, normally when there's a choice of products to do a certain job, we say there's no monopoly. But when it's a choice of proprietary software packages to do the job, it's actually a choice between monopolies. The poor user who chooses this proprietary program then has to deal with this monopoly for support afterwards. And if the user makes the mistake of choosing this proprietary program, support afterwards is this monopoly, a choice between monopolies. Paradoxical, but true. And this illustrates a much more general principle. Freedom does not mean having a choice between a few options. Freedom is much bigger than the freedom to choose. Freedom means having control of your own life. To have the choice between proprietary software packages is being able to choose your master. Freedom means not having a master. Having a choice between proprietary programs is nothing like freedom. So I've explained the four freedoms and why they are essential for a free society, for users who can be free both individually and as parts of communities, free to cooperate. And so the motto of the free software movement is freedom and community. Those are our values. In 1983, I had reached the conclusion that I wanted to be able to live in freedom and still use a computer. But that was impossible in 1983 because the computer won't do anything without an operating system. And in 1983, all the operating systems for modern computers were proprietary. In fact, you had to sign a non-disclosure agreement even to get the binary version of the operating system, a contract promising to betray the whole world, promising not to share with anybody. And source code was totally unavailable to ordinary users. So the second step in starting to use a computer right after getting the computer was to betray the whole world to get a proprietary operating system. I wanted to change this, but what could I do? I was one man with no particular skill or experience in politics. Most people didn't agree with me. I didn't think I had much chance of changing this situation by lobbying the government or persuading software developing companies to change their policies. But there was one thing I was good at, and that was developing software. specifically operating system software. That was my field, my love. And I realized that I could change this situation, I could solve this problem by developing software. All I had to do was develop another operating system that would be free software. And this would give everybody a way to use a computer in freedom. People could just turn their backs on those proprietary systems. We wouldn't have to win over their developers, we could just reject them. When I realized this, I realized that it would probably be the most important thing I would ever have a chance to try to do in my life. And I concluded that I had been elected by circumstances to do this job. I was concerned about the problem of user subjugating, user dividing software. And most people didn't care. I had the skills to try to implement this solution. And probably no one was going to do it if I did not. So I had to do it. It's as if you saw someone drowning and you knew how to swim, and it's not Bush, then you have a moral duty to save that person. Well, I don't know how to swim, but in this case, the work that needed doing was writing software, which I did know how to do. So I decided, oh, I'm sorry, my statement was a bit too strong. You probably shouldn't save Cheney either. So I decided that I would write a free software operating system or die trying. Of old age, presumably. Because at the time, the free software movement that I was launching had no enemies. There were plenty of people who didn't agree. But they weren't making efforts to try to stop us from developing a free operating system. They just laughed and didn't do anything. The obstacle was therefore not explicit opposition, it was simply a lot of work. An operating system is a big job. And I didn't know when I started developing this system if I would ever see it finished. I was just determined to do my best. Well, this decision led to other decisions that had to be made, such as what kind of system should it be? What design should I use? Well, at the time, there were many different computer architectures that were popular, and new ones came every year or so. So I realized that by the time this system was finished, which would take years, I didn't know what kind of computers people would be using. If I didn't want the system to be obsolete before it was finished, it had to be portable. But I only had seen one successful portable operating system, and that was Unix. So I decided to follow the design of Unix. That way, I'd have a better chance of making a system that would be portable and really work. Furthermore, Unix, because it was popular, had an interface that many users already knew. So I realized by making this system upward compatible with Unix, I could make it easy for all those people to switch. So I decided to make the system upward compatible with Unix. But that had an interesting consequence. You see, Unix consists of many components. Back then, it was already hundreds of components that communicate through various interfaces, and the users also used the same interfaces to talk to these components. So to be compatible with Unix meant keeping all the same interfaces and replacing each component compatibly one by one, which meant that the initial design decisions were already made, except for just one. What range of computers should I try to support? Unix had been designed to run on 16-bit computers, and because their address space is so small, people had to do a lot of extra work to get the programs to run using small amounts of memory. But I predicted, this was the only time in my life that I've made a prediction about technology and actually depended on it, I predicted that by the time the system was done, everybody would be getting 32-bit computers. So I decided not to even bother with 16-bit computers. Make the job easy. Assume that you've got a big memory, you can read the whole file into memory and operate it on it. That made things less work. And indeed, that happened. By the time there was a complete free system, everyone was getting 32-bit computers or better. So, because the initial design decisions were all made, the only thing I needed to start work was a name. In the community which I belonged to in the 1970s, a community of programmers who programmed primarily for the joy of it. Some of us were getting paid and some were students, but the main motivation was the joy. We often gave programs funny or mischievous names, because that was half the fun of writing the program, imagining the users laughing at the name. And we had a specific custom that when you developed a program that was similar to some existing program, you could give it a name that was a recursive acronym saying that your program was not the other one. For instance, in 1975, I wrote the first Emacs text editor. And afterwards, there were dozens of imitations of Emacs, and some were called this or that Emacs, you know, the most obvious thing to do. But some people found recursive acronyms for their imitations, such as fine for fine is not Emacs, and sign for sign is not Emacs, and Ina for Ina is not Emacs, and mince for mince is not complete Emacs. And version 2 of Ina was called Zwei, for Zwei was Ina initially. So you can have lots of fun with recursive acronyms. I decided to look for a recursive acronym for something is not Unix. So I tried the most obvious four-letter approach, and I saw that none of those was a word. Well, if it doesn't have another meaning, it's not a joke. That's no good. So what can I do? Well, what if I make a contraction? Then I could get a three-letter recursive acronym. Would it work? Well, let me try every letter. Anu, bnu, knu, dnu, enu, fnu, gnu. Well, gnu is the funniest word in the English language. I couldn't resist. You know, there was even a funny song based on the word gnu when I was a child. And then they had all the people who said to their friends, hey, what's gnu? Instead of, hey, what's new? So many jokes made up based on the word gnu. The idea that that G is supposed to be silent is so silly that we just have to make jokes up about pronouncing it as gnu instead of new. However, when it's the name of our operating system, please do not follow the dictionary. If you talk about the new operating system, you'll get people very confused. We've been working on it for 22 years now, so it's not new anymore. But it still is GNU, and it always will be GNU, no matter how many people pronounce it erroneously Linux. Could be. But so in September 1983, I posted an announcement on the net asking for people to join in and help. And in January, on actually January 5th, 22 years ago tomorrow, I resigned from my job at MIT to start developing GNU. Now, there was a very practical reason to resign from MIT. If I had remained an MIT employee, the MIT administration could have said, the copyright on this work belongs to us, and we're going to make it a proprietary software product, and there would have been nothing I could do to stop them. So I quit my job and took them out of the equation. However, the head of the lab was nice enough to offer me the use of the computers there to work on developing GNU. So I started using a Unix machine there to do it. That was actually the first time I used Unix. I made the decision to imitate Unix without ever having used it. Fortunately, it turned out to be an okay decision. When I started using Unix, I saw a few ugly things, but they weren't too bad. So I proceeded with the decision. Initially, there was one other person working on the system along with me. And our job was to write all these replacement components so that we'd have a complete system. Fortunately, as time went on, more people joined in and we got more components. Eventually, I made a list of the components that were missing that was called the GNU task list. Initially, it was a list of components of Unix plus a few other things that I thought were important. And now it's a list of applications that we'd like to have, because we have the operating system. And then in October 1985, we started the Free Software Foundation, whose idea was to raise funds for development of GNU. The reason was that I had released GNU Emacs earlier in 1985, and it was becoming popular. And I figured, now that people see we can develop real software, that this is not just talk, not just vaporware, maybe now they'll give money. So it was time to set up a tax-exempt organization they could donate to. However, the FSF, now, early in 1985, when GNU Emacs was first released, of course, I put a copy in an FTP server, and that way people on the net could get copies. But some programmers then were not on the internet. They couldn't FTP a copy. They sent me messages that were relayed through phone calls, which was called Usenet, and or UUCP, or I don't really know the difference between the two. I never used it, you see. So I got these emails asking, how can I get a copy? I'm not on the internet. What could I tell them? Well, I could have told them, I want to spend my time writing additional components of GNU, not writing a tape for you. So please find a friend who's on the net who will download it and put it on tape and give it to you. And they would have got copies sooner or later. Programmers know other programmers, generally. But I had no job. In fact, I've never had a job since then. So I was looking for some way I could make money by working on free software. So I said, send me $150 and I'll mail you a tape of Emacs. And the orders began trickling in. By the middle of the year, I was getting 8 to 10 orders a month. It was enough money that if necessary, I could have lived on it. So I had a free software business. But when we started the Free Software Foundation, it seemed appropriate for the FSF to take over selling Emacs tapes. And I didn't want to compete with the FSF while being its president, so I stopped selling Emacs tapes. And instead, I made a living for several years through free software support, providing support on the programs that I had written. And so the FSF got money and started hiring a few programmers to write additional pieces of the system. The idea being, aiming as quickly as possible to get to the point where we had an entire system. By 1990, the only major component still missing was the kernel. We had utilized some big pieces that had been developed by other projects for other reasons. For instance, there was the text formatter TECH, which was free software. and there was the X window system that was free software. The people who developed these programs didn't intend to aim for a complete free operating system. They'd never thought about the question. But their work was free software, so we could use it. Meanwhile, I had developed a particular kind of free software license, which we call copyleft. You see, there are many ways to release a program as free software. As long as it has the four essential freedoms, it's free software. There are various ways to do that. One is to put it in the public domain. But if the program is in the public domain, then others can make modified versions of it proprietary. They might not release the source code. They might put on a license that explicitly restricts people and makes it non-free. Other programs had used various free software licenses, such as Tech, for instance. And that license permitted non-free versions. And this was a problem. Tech itself was free software. But in the mid-80s, there were non-free versions of Tech, and that was causing trouble. So I realized just releasing a program and saying, okay, just everyone do everything with it, would not result in delivering freedom to all the users. Because middlemen would get in the way and strip off the freedom and pass along something without freedom to the rest of the public. So I decided to look for a way to stop this from happening. And the method I developed is called copyleft because it's based legally on copyright. We use copyright law, but instead of using it for its usual purpose, which is to subjugate people, we use it for exactly the opposite purpose, which is to protect people's freedom. Here's how it works. When we develop a program in the GNU project, we release it under a license called the GNU General Public License. And this license says, first of all, copyright. This program is copyrighted. And then you're free to copy it and distribute the copies. You're free to modify it and distribute modified versions. But there are conditions, there are requirements, and the requirements add up to whoever gets it from you must get the same freedom that you got from us. So every user gets freedom. So today, there are two broad categories of free software. There's copylefted free software. Almost 3/4 of all free software packages use the GNU General Public License. And there are some other copyleft licenses as well. And then there is non-copylefted free software, which is a minority, but includes some important packages. Both of them count as free, because in both cases, the developers respect your freedom. The developers have not denied you any freedom that's essential. But in the case of copylefted software, the developers have gone even further, and they have actively defended your freedom from anyone else who might try to take it away. Now, it's a fact that in our community, most of the users have not come to appreciate and value freedom. So if we rely on each user to insist on freedom, we're weak. It's much stronger if the developers say that by copyleft they will defend actively the freedom of all users of their software. So by 1990, the only essential component missing was the kernel. And we, at that point, had been looking for a way that we could get a shortcut in developing a kernel. I had been looking for something I could use as a starting point so that we wouldn't have to write it from zero. And what I found in that year was Mach. Mach is a so-called microkernel. It provides the lower level parts of kernel functionalities. And the idea is that you write other programs that run on top of Mach and run in user space, and they do the rest of the job. And I thought, all right, Mach does half the job, we only have to do half. And those are user space programs. We could debug them with a user space symbolic debugger, which will make it easier to get them to work. So I thought this would be quick and easy. It turned out to be rather complicated. And it took many years to get this collection of programs, which we call the GNU Herd, to run at all. By the way, it's the GNU Herd because GNUs live in herds. So this is a herd of GNU servers. And it's spelled H-U-R-D, which stands for Herd of Unix Replacement Demons. Except the herd that refers to is spelled H-I-R-D and stands for something else, so it's two mutually recursive acronyms carrying it perhaps a bit too far, but after all, it's meant to be fun. But that's not the name I originally wanted it to have. I originally wanted that collection of programs to be called Alex. You see, at the time, I had a girlfriend, and she was the manager of a Unix computing facility. And at one point, she had told her friends, you know, with my name, they ought to name a kernel after me someday. So I thought, I'll spring it on her as a surprise. But the person who we hired to actually write the kernel, he preferred the name Herd, and he changed it. It took many years, till 1996, before we had it running at all. And it still doesn't run reliably. In fact, there seem to be deep problems in how to design such a system to make it work well enough. Fortunately, we didn't have to wait for that, because in 1991, a college student in Finland wrote his own kernel, and he used the tried and true monolithic design. And he got it to barely work in less than a year. Initially, this kernel, which was called Linux, was not free software. It became free software in 1992, when the developer changed to the GNU General Public License. See, anyone can release a program under the GNU General Public License. You don't have to be part of the GNU project. You just have to write a program and decide to use this license. That's how it became so popular. So once Linux, the kernel, was free software, it was possible to make a complete free system as the combination of GNU, which had a gap, and Linux, which filled the gap. The system, which consisted of GNU plus Linux, was the first complete free operating system for PCs. For the first time, it was possible to go and buy a computer and then run it. For the first time since the 1970s, it was possible to buy a computer and run it with all free software. And thus, the goal that we had set out for in 1983 had been achieved. Linus Torvalds took the final step that carried us across the finish line, which he was able to do because we had taken so many steps before that point. However, at that time, a confusion developed. People started calling the GNU system Linux, or the whole combination, which was basically GNU, although with Linux added. They started calling the whole combination Linux, and that's rather unfair to us. Now, Linux is an important part of the system, and I don't mind giving its developer an important piece of the credit. But the GNU project is the system's principal developer, and we ought to get at least equal mention. So if you want to be fair, you should call it the GNU/Linux system or the GNU plus Linux system. It's the combination of those two. But there's something more at stake here than just credit. Credit is a matter of ego, and ego is not really what's important. So sometimes people have advised me, they've given me advice that would be wise, except for one assumption that's not true. They say, it doesn't look good to ask for credit, and that's true. So when people call the system Linux, you should smile to yourself and take pride in a job well done. Now this would be wise advice if the assumption were true, the assumption that the job is done. We have made a great beginning, but that's all it is. We have developed three operating systems, since Solaris was made free software a year ago. And then we have two free graphical interface desktops, two free office suites, we have thousands of free applications, but we need thousands more in order to be able to do the job we are aiming to do, which is to make it easy for people to do everything they want to do with their computers and never feel tempted to give up their freedom. So we have a lot of work to do. Free operating systems, well, the GNU/Linux system is used by tens of millions of users, perhaps 100 million. But proprietary systems are used by many hundreds of millions. So we have, and even most of the people who use GNU/Linux are using some non-free software with it. So we have a long way to go before we achieve our goal, which is the liberation of cyberspace and everyone in it. We have a lot of work to do, and we need to press on with determination. History shows us that people who do not defend their freedom lose it. And we don't have to look very far back. The past few years in the US are sufficient. But in order to defend their freedom, people have to value it. And in order to value it, they have to know what it is. When it comes to traditional freedoms, such as the freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, freedom from arbitrary imprisonment, freedom from unreasonable searches and seizures, these freedoms have recently become very hard to defend, but at least people know what they are. When it comes to the freedoms that people, that users of software must have, we're still trying to teach the world what they are. And if you look around our community, you'll see that a lot of the institutions in it talk about Linux, not GNU, and they talk about convenience, not freedom. The name Linux has never been very much associated with freedom as a goal. The name GNU is. So when we talk to people about the importance of freedom in using software and how this is a goal that we should work to achieve, sometimes the users of the GNU system respond by saying, "What has that got to do with me? I'm a Linux user." How ironic. If only they knew that the system they're using is basically GNU, they still might not agree with us, but at least they'd see more reason to pay attention and consider our views seriously. The mistake of calling the GNU system Linux hurt the free software movement by breaking the connection in most people's minds from our software to our philosophy. You see, before that, people who used our software were led to look at our philosophy because they knew it was the philosophy that motivated the development of the system. But when they think the system is Linux, they tend to look towards the political views of Linus Torvalds. And he describes himself as apolitical. He doesn't want to advocate a political position. He doesn't say that non-free software takes away your freedom. He doesn't say that's wrong. Up until early this year, early last year, he was using a non-free program in a very public way for development of Linux. And this set a very bad example. Fortunately, there were enough people involved in the development of Linux who did care about freedom that they eventually made this change. Andrew Trigil developed a program that interoperated with the non-free program, whereupon its developer withdrew permission for its use and thus erased the problem he had created for us by offering the temptation to use it in the first place. As long as Linux development was using that non-free program, it was conveying the message that freedom doesn't matter, that freedom is not important, that that's not what it's all about. It was urging you to care only about powerful, reliable software and not care about your freedom. Well, I'm glad that has stopped, but we still have a big job to do to teach people the importance of freedom. Now, if you want to spend substantial time, you can actively help us. I hope that some of you here will do that. But all of you can do something that takes a few seconds a day that will help prepare the way to make our work more effective. If you call the system GNU/Linux, when you're talking to other users or other people who might become users or the public, then later on, when they come across what the GNU project says about freedom, they'll realize, oh, I've heard that the system I'm using is GNU/Linux. Maybe that statement about freedom has something to do with the system I appreciate. And maybe they'll pay more attention to the arguments we've made, and maybe we'll convince them. You can't convince people with a few seconds a day, but you can prepare the way. And so I ask you, please, to do that. Because today, the free software movement has something we didn't have at the beginning. We have enemies. Government in Washington actively try to buy the support of any influential institution and try to pressure those institutions into using Windows so that they direct society down the path of subjugation. The U.S. Trade Representative actively tries to pressure other countries to do this. They try to claim that countries have no right to adopt a policy favoring free software. The existing trade treaties are thoroughly evil, but they don't, in fact, say this. However, the Microsoft government in Washington tries to impose this anyway. And of course, nothing stops Microsoft from offering attractive special deals to institutions that can influence the path followed by the rest of society. Why does Microsoft donate gratis copies of Windows to schools and students? It's not because they care about the future of society or education. It's the same reason why tobacco companies used to hand out gratis packs of cigarettes. They want to make those students addicted and thus keep society in a position of dependence. And this is why every school's duty is to refuse to accept those poisonous donations, just as they would refuse to accept donations of cigarettes for their students. We face a widespread conspiracy led by companies such as Intel and IBM and Microsoft with the participation of many others. They call it trusted computing, we call it treacherous computing. It's just a matter of your point of view. The plan is to impose on the public a redesign of future computers to ensure that in the future, software developers have the control over the users once again. They want to make it impossible to independently program computers to do certain jobs. They want to set the computers up so that no independently written program can possibly access certain data, can possibly communicate with certain services. They want to make free software for these jobs technically impossible. So when they say this is trusted computing, they mean that the software developers, that the companies, can trust your computer to obey them and not you. From their point of view, it's trusted. From your point of view, it's treacherous. And I'd rather take your point of view. We face problems with various areas of hardware, but the specifications are secret, that we can't find out how to write software to run that hardware. They won't tell us. It requires substantial efforts of reverse engineering to figure out how to control that hardware. So we face a great challenge. It's no longer just a matter of developing a lot of software. Now we have to organize politically to fight against digital restrictions management, to fight against treacherous computing, to fight against software patents. In Europe, the free software community led the way in a successful fight that for the first time convinced the European Parliament to stand up against what the bureaucrats wanted. The European Parliament rejected the directive to authorize software patents in Europe. It was not our community alone, but the heart of the resistance came from our community. The leadership came from our community, which shows that we can win political battles even on the largest scale, if we are motivated to try. Do we have the energy to make efforts to defend our freedom, or will we leave this up to others, leave the outcome up to happenstance? That's the crucial decision we face. So, I will now close the speech. First, I should mention that I have some contact cards to hand out to people who would like the FSF to be able to get in touch with them. Take a contact card, fill it out, and hand it back today. You can also use the back to make a donation with a credit card if you want. Either way, hand it back today. Mailing it in would be unnecessary trouble for you. I also have some cards you can use to join the FSF as an associate member. I think that's the main source of funding for the FSF now, so we really need your support.
Can you get that online too?
Yes, you can also join the FSF online. I also have some things to give out. I have some GNU and Linux stickers. Please take the quantity of stickers that you can put to good use, which means putting them in a permanent place where people will see it and it will spread the word. I also have some things for sale. I've got a few copies of my book of essays, Free Software, Free Society. You can also order that through fsf.org. And I've got some FSF pins and key rings for sale. But that'll be after questions. But first, I want to present my alter ego. sometimes people have accused me of having a holier-than-thou attitude about free software. Well, I think they're mistaken. When I see a person who's not doing all that he or she could to promote free software, what I do is I urge the person to do more. I'm not looking for opportunities to browbeat people. I want to help the cause. However, it's true that I have a holy attitude because I'm a saint. I'm supposed to be holy. It's possible, still conceivable, that that might happen. Fortunately, even Microsoft seems to have some scruples. As far as I know, it has never tried to have anyone killed. Unlike some other companies like Coca-Cola. I am Saint Ignatius of the Church of Emacs. I bless your computer, my child. Emacs started out as a text editor, which became a way of life for many users because they could do all their work without ever exiting from Emacs. And ultimately, it became a religion when people started the news group alt.religion.emacs. And today, we have a great schism between two rival versions of Emacs, and we also have saints. Fortunately, no gods. Instead of gods, we adore an editor. To be a member of the Church of Emacs, you must recite the Confession of the Faith. You must say, there is no system but GNU, and Linux is one of its kernels. The Church of Emacs has certain advantages compared with some other churches I won't name. For instance, to be a saint in the Church of Emacs does not require celibacy. So if you've been searching for a church to be saintly in, you might want to consider ours. But it does require living a life of moral purity. You must exorcise any evil proprietary operating systems that have possessed any of the computers under your control. And then you must install a wholly free operating system. And then only install free software on top of that. If you make this vow and you live by it, then you too will be a saint, and you may eventually have a halo if you can find one, because they don't make them anymore. Sometimes people ask me whether it is a sin in the Church of Emacs to use the text editor VI. It's true that VI is the editor of the beast. But using a free version of VI is not a sin, it's a penance. And sometimes people ask me if my halo is really an old computer disk. This is no computer disk, this is my halo. But it was a computer disk in a previous life. So, thank you. Oh, I should mention that very soon, in under 2 weeks, we're going to announce the first draft of GPL version 3. Which we've been working on rather heavily for several months. And that will be the opportunity for people to comment on it and try to point out problems, although we hope there aren't any, and make suggestions. And there is a special website to do this called gplv3.fsf.org. For more information about GNU and free software, look at www.gnu.org. For more information about the Free Software Foundation, look at fsf.org. And that's where you would go to join or to buy anything. And there is an event going on in Boston, the 16th and 17th of this month. If you want to attend, you can register at gplv3.fsf.org.